wonderful day for Kim and I yesterday as well. And it was very enjoyable talking to many of you and seeing what was kind of impacting you and all of that stuff. Just so you know that I'm not a snob. I don't just sneak out of here and refuse to see people. I went home to Mary Charlotte's last night, put a fire on, had some supper. Kim and I chatted. I actually crocheted a baby outfit and relaxed and went to bed at 7 o'clock. So I continue to have to very carefully monitor my health situation to stay stable. If I overdo it too much, I go downhill in a hurry. And so that is not me being a snob. It's just me trying to take care of what God's given me so I can minister effectively. One of the questions, just to lead into what I'm going to talk about today, is we spent yesterday talking about addiction, but mainly about complex trauma. And when I deal with addicts, I really don't talk a lot about addiction. I talk about complex trauma because that's the real issue. And if they don't get help there, they're not going to stay clean and sober. But the question I get asked regularly, especially from Christians, is complex trauma in the Bible? Or to say it another way, some that are very legalistic and narrow say, you're teaching secular psychology, so we don't believe God can bless your ministry because we only teach what the Bible teaches. And part of my response to that is I don't think the secular and sacred are in opposition to each other. God designed this world so it all is harmonious. That was the idea of university. You take all the schools of thought, including theology, and you put them together, and it's a unified whole. And that was God's design. But the Bible doesn't use complex trauma, the term. But once you understand complex trauma and you start reading the Bible, you find out that complex trauma is a big part of the Bible, and it opens up your understanding to the Bible a lot. So just for an example, 6 or 7 years ago, I was thinking in my own mind, the clearest example of complex trauma in the Bible would be Israel when they were in slavery. Every day was full of danger and abuse, all of those things. And then God brought them out of slavery. They have complex trauma. So I studied very carefully the 40 years Israel was in the wilderness, 40 years after coming out of slavery. And you know what I saw as I studied that? They had complex trauma so bad that every one of the 50 characteristics I talked about yesterday shows up. But even more interesting, people ask me all the time, why do people relapse? Why do they want to go back to the very thing that was a cruel taskmaster? You want to know what you find as you go through Israel in the wilderness? A couple days in, we think we should go back to being slaves again because we're going to die out here. God doesn't love us. He just brought us out here to kill us. 6 months later, they're picking a leader to go back to slavery. And you go, what is with that? But that's complex trauma. You go back to what is familiar, even though it destroys you. And so it's full in the Bible. But what I want to do this morning is take you to Genesis 1 and 4, the beginning of the Bible. And what stood out to me as I studied that is that as Christians, we tend to focus on only one part of those four chapters. But as you look at them in total, you begin to see God has not only put complex trauma in the first chapters of the Bible, but he's explained why it's there. And that's what I want to develop for you this morning. And hopefully it'll just fill out your understanding of it. So if you're familiar with the Bible, Genesis 3 is the Adam and Eve eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. God said you can eat all from any of the trees in the garden except that tree. And Satan comes along and he says, God doesn't want you to eat of that tree because it'll make you so you don't need him. You'll be smarter than God. And they believed the lie, they ate of the tree, and that's where all the trouble started. And so what that chapter says to us and its purpose in the Bible is like this. Our society today is always saying, what's the root problem to our society? We see divorces, we see abuse, we see the effects of residential schools in the Aboriginal community. We see all kinds of problems in our society today, and we spend billions of dollars every year trying to fix problems, but nothing seems to be getting any better. So we use education, we use social services, we use jails, all of those things. What's the cause that goes deeper than all of the other things to the very root? And God says you'll never figure it out on your own, so I'll tell you, Genesis 3. It starts with a spiritual problem. And the problem is this, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. In Hebrew, that was a figure of speech. And it meant you thought you didn't need God because you were smarter than God. And so that's what God is saying, is where did all the trouble go begin? Where did it all go wrong? Is that we by nature said, I think I'm smarter than God. And that's what we say in recovery and addiction all the time, is our problem is we think we're smarter than everybody else. And what God is saying is, if you will listen to me, I will tell you how to live a healthy life, and I will tell you the root of the problems, and it has a spiritual center. Now, the problem with most Christians is we stop there. We don't read chapter 4. Do you want to know what happens in chapter 4? It goes this way. What happens when people think they're smarter than God? Well, how will that display itself in their life and their relationships? So you come into chapter 4, Cain kills his brother Abel. Then you get another guy called Nimrod, and he said, somebody offended me, so I am going to give them revenge 70 times greater than they gave me. And all of a sudden you see people hurting each other and people creating a very dangerous world, so they had to move into cities to try to find protection. And so Genesis 4 is saying, when people turn against God, they start wounding each other. And that creates a society with problems, that creates complex trauma. And so the whole beginning of the Bible says, yes, it starts spiritual, but it then moves out to affect everybody. Okay, then what I did after that was say, okay, one of the common things that I deal with all the time as I deal with an addict brand new into recovery is this. I always felt an emptiness in my heart. Like there's a hole there. Something was missing. I don't know what. I tried to fill it with drugs, alcohol, sex, whatever, but it didn't satisfy. Where did that hole come from? What is that about? And if you talk to anybody that grew up in complex trauma, and if you weren't here yesterday, it just means somebody growing up not feeling safe. So they live in fight-flight mode as a way to escape or fight back to protect themselves from getting hurt. And so I began to ask myself, does Genesis 1 to 4 give us a clue as to maybe where the hole in our heart comes from? And again, the danger is many Christians have said, the hole in your heart is just because there's a spiritual vacuum. And I don't disagree with that, but I think it's too narrow. Because I think what Genesis 1 to 4 says, there's other things that create a hole in your heart. And you need to understand them just as well as the spiritual vacuum. So as I looked through Genesis 1 to 4, I began to write down every need or drive that God reveals in Genesis 1 to 4 that all of us have as human beings. So that's what I want to walk you through very quickly and then give you some observations and pull it all together. I don't know if you ever thought or asked yourself, why did God create the world in the first place? Why did God create humans? What we are told about God in Timothy in the New Testament is God is forever the fullness of joy. And what that is very interesting to me is we believe that God was three in one, a Trinity. And what we then conclude is that God was forever the happiest in that relationship. And God interacted the Father with the Son and the Holy Spirit, and they experienced this overwhelming joy. Now let me take that. My wife and I get married. We have a great marriage. We're full of joy. Guess what we want to do? Have a baby to share the joy. And so what God said is, I want to create a world, because I've got so much joy that I want others to feel it and to live it and be part of it. And so the first thing that God wired us for is to pursue joy, to pursue happiness, to pursue pleasure. Addiction does it the wrong way, but God has wired us to do that. Now, if you were to look at the decisions you make over any given day, stop and think, how many of them are determined by, will this make me happy? Will this be something I enjoy? Now, if you were to ask me, what would you like for supper, steak or liver? That's a no-brainer in my world. Liver does not give me pleasure. I had to endure it enough as a kid. Steak gives me pleasure. I will choose steak. So joy or happiness guides many of the decisions we make because God wired us that way, to always be pursuing that. Then we quickly see God made us with hunger, thirst, and that is the need to survive physically. We need food and water and shelter. So we have physical needs. But we don't end with physical needs. So if you look at our culture today, all of the emphasis is on providing for people's physical needs. If you even look at parenting classes today, much of the focus is on making sure your child, your baby that's to be born, their physical needs are met well. But God made us more than a physical being. He made us emotional beings. He made us relational beings. He made us spiritual beings as well. And so what we then find is those things showing up in the book of Genesis. So the first thing God says to Adam and Eve, be fruitful and multiply. How was that going to happen? Through sex. So God created us with a sex drive. We understand that. And then God created us with, most people, with a desire to have children, to have a family, procreation. That is wired into us to keep the human race going. Part of that, and what is really important, I think the significance of the Trinity is that God says you can't survive alone. Joy comes through intimacy within relationships. So what does every little child say when they're quite young? I want a friend. We're driven to seek relationships, friendships. And then part of that is we want to feel that we fit in, that we belong. And so a child that doesn't feel like they fit in their family, they feel like the black sheep, they will go and try to fit in. So in my day as a kid, there were the jocks, there were the nerds, and then there were the potheads. Now you get the cokeheads and everybody else. But you tried to fit in, and that was very important, to belong. But at some point in your teens, you get tired of just banter and superficial friendships. You're driven to find an intimate relationship. And God said, for this cause shall a man and a woman leave their mother and father, and they will become one. And that is the depth of true, deep intimacy wired into us. So we seek that out. And then within that, as you go into Genesis, you see that God says we need to have healthy relationships with true intimacy. There's certain characteristics, certain things that are needed. Love. There needs to be a nurturing environment. So when Adam and Eve sinned, there were consequences, but God also nurtured them and comforted them and forgave them and accepted them. All of those things were built into what we need. So if you look at any child, something in them longs to be accepted. When they are hurting, they long for a hug. When they are feeling insecure, they long to feel security that comes by being respected and valued for who they are, wired into us. And then we need safety and security. If you were to look at what causes many people complex trauma, it is that they never felt value for being them. They only felt value for performing. And so you get young people that come in, especially girls, live with this, where they felt no value at home, and then all of a sudden they're getting all of this attention for their body. And they go, oh, I guess my value comes from my body. So I have to be fit. I can never get old, or else I'm going to have a crisis if I start losing the body. I don't know if you have it out here, but in Winnipeg we have what we call the cougars and the pumas. I don't know if you know what they are. For you church people, I'll give you a quick kind of societal education. A cougar is a woman who's still got it. And she can still get the young guys. And they still notice her. A puma is a 50 plus that's still got it. And so that is kind of slang terminology. But it's for a person who's put all of their value in their body and how they perform sexually. And I've had many clients who as kids kept track of how many people they slept with, because now they were better than everybody else because they slept with more people. That was the basis of their value. But yet they know it doesn't satisfy. It leaves them insecure, because there's always the danger that somebody's going to come along who's prettier than them, who's more attractive than them. And so they live with always feeling insecure and needing to prove that they're better than everybody. That's not true value. God made us wanting to be validated for being us without performing. That is deeply wired into us. In order to feel safe, a child needs boundaries. They did a thing back in the 70s where it was kind of that freedom, hippie time, and they said schoolyards that have fences make kids feel like they're in prison. We should get rid of the schoolyard fences. So they said, good, we'll do that. Guess what happened? All the kids huddled in the center of the schoolyard because they didn't feel safe. And so what we realize is kids need boundaries in order to feel protected and safe. And that is part of growing up. They need justice. What is one of the favorite, or not favorite, but common things that a child will say? That's not fair. And that hurts them and gets them angry and they cry. We are driven for justice. We are driven to have fair as part of life. It's wired into us. And then God said that he said, you are going to produce crops by the sweat of your brow. There will be thorns and thistles. But what he is saying is you have to work. And that is where you have a sense of purpose. Now, we in our society have many people that do their jobs, but that's not what we would call their vocation. That's just how they pay the bills. A vocation is when you get the privilege, like I do, of doing a job that suits your passion. And then you go, yes, this is where I belong. This is what I was made for. And you have this sense of fulfillment because of a sense of purpose. Now, here's a very interesting thing about the latest generation from 2000 onward is this. They have every gizmo and gadget and toy and electronic technology beyond anything that the world has ever had. They've got social media that keeps them connected. Do you want to know what the young people of our generation is saying? What is my purpose? Why am I here? I just feel like I'm here for me. And am I indulging my desires? And that feels so empty. And so what they are recognizing is that something deep inside of them longs to make a difference, longs to have a sense of purpose. And so God has given that and placed it in us, and it drives us. And so for many people, they get involved in service opportunities, volunteering type of things where they can make a difference. That is wired in. Flip side of that, though, there's always the danger that we become a workaholic. And so God said, work 6 days, but take the seventh off, because you need rest. You need balance in life. And we're not good at balance sometimes. And if you, like me, grew up with parents that came out of the Depression, you never wasted time. I never remember once my mom not working. Even when she was watching TV, she was knitting, she was mending clothes. She was constantly doing something, because if you relaxed, you were made to feel guilty. And God said, no, you need to learn to take care of yourself. And that means you need rest. And you need times that are stress-free. That's why I justify going to Hawaii, because I need that. So don't get a resentment at me. But that is an important part of life that is built into us. Our society is now the whole 55-plus generation where you retire at 50. And you know what happens with many people who retire at 50? Why am I here? This is boring. I thought I was going to find this excitement. And they didn't get that vocation and purpose and significance part right. And so they're human doers that their identity comes out of their job, take their job away, and they feel useless. And so that is a big thing. Beauty. God has wired us for beauty. Why do many people love the mountains in Vancouver and BC? The beauty. Why do people travel? They love beauty. Why is art such a big thing? We're wired for beauty. And then the next one I always find fascinating. We're wired for wow, or we need to feel a sense of awe. I always like to think when we took our children for the first time in Winnipeg to see the fireworks, and it was Canada Day, and they saw the fireworks and their eyes were as big as saucers, and they were wow. They were just in awe. They almost couldn't put words to it. And what you saw in them is that awe gave them a sense of pleasure that went very much deeper than many other things in their lives. Here's the problem. If we took our children every day for a month to watch the fireworks, guess what would happen on day 30? This is boring. And so what you realize in life is we love an awe experience, but to maintain the awe, we need a greater awe and a greater awe and a greater awe. And guess what the beauty of God is? He's the only infinite being, so you can keep getting to know him better and better, and you'll never run out of God. And you will always end up worshiping. It will never get old if you're truly getting to know God. But we are wired for wow. So what do many people do in our culture today? It's called extreme sports. Let's go skydiving. Let's go bungee jumping. What's that? The wow. The adrenaline wow. I almost killed myself, but it sure pumped me up. Let's do it again. And so we seek the wow in many different ways. And then the 11th one. So if you look at that, there's physical needs there. There's relational needs. There's emotional needs. God's wired us with all of those. And then number 11, God wired us with a spiritual hunger, a spiritual need for God and that the experience of something bigger and greater than us. So those are the first 11. And I'm going to give you the 12th in just a minute, but I want to say just a couple comments at this point. Here's how I think of human life and how I think of recovery. If all 11 of those needs that are built into us by God, if they are met consistently, guess what we feel? Joy, contentment, satisfaction. We feel whole and complete. That is the way we were wired. But if one of those is missing, we feel an emptiness. And it doesn't just have to be a spiritual need missing. It can be a physical, it can be an emotional, it can be a relational need. But we will feel an emptiness. Now here's the tragedy of complex trauma. Of those 11 needs, for most people in complex trauma, they may have got the physical ones met consistently, but they never got any of the others. And so they have a massive hole in their heart. Now it would be wrong of me to come to them and say, you just need the spiritual peace and you'll be fixed. No, what I have to do is to say, what is recovery? It is getting healthy in all areas. It is learning to meet all 12 needs in a consistent, healthy way. And that is a journey. Because what happens for people who didn't get those needs met in childhood is they also didn't get the tools to know how to meet those needs. So now they come into recovery, they don't have hardly any of those needs met, they don't have the tools to know how to meet those needs, and somebody says, get healthy. That is not something that happens overnight. It is a journey, it is a slow process, but that is what is there. But let me take it a step further. If a person has one or more of those needs not met and they feel this discontent and dissatisfaction, it points out the final, the 12th need. We need contentment. We are wired for contentment. And if we don't have a need met, we feel discontent. And here's the next part you have to understand. Our brain was wired for contentment. And if there's one bit of discontentment in us, our brain cannot relax. Our brain becomes antsy. And what our brain begins to do is to say, what could I do to find contentment? What am I missing? What do I need to do to feel complete? And it's exploring options. And that's what the brain begins to do. And for people who don't know and never have been taught how to meet their needs, their brain goes squirrely. Because it is looking for solutions. It is trying all kinds of different things. And what I'm going to show you, the things that it tries seem to work, but they don't really work. So a person is set up for addiction, not just to drugs and alcohol, but to gossip, to food, to sleep, to sex, to all kinds of different things when one or more of those needs aren't being met in their life. They get discontent and their brain begins to explore options. And so what begins to happen is two different things. Now, I need to point out, for a little child, all of this is happening at a subconscious level. They're not saying, oh, I feel discontent. Their brain is just operating without them being consciously aware of what is happening. So number one, what God did in order to get us to meet our needs is he made the fulfillment of a particular need satisfying. It gave us pleasure. So if you eat food when you're really hungry, you sit back and rub your tummy and you go, oh, that was so good. So God made the fulfillment of needs pleasurable things. But he put boundaries on what was the right or healthy way to meet that need. So there's a healthy way to use food, which is to meet physical needs. But when we meet the physical needs, it has a joyful emotional experience. God did not give us food to meet sadness or stress or frustration or anger. So there's a boundary on healthy use of food, and outside of that is unhealthy use of food. So guess what happens? A child, let's say a three-year-old, doesn't have 11 of those 12 needs met. They're in complex trauma in a more severe way. One day, grandma offers them some chocolate ice cream. And they go, wow, I have never felt so good in all my life. I have just found the solution to my problems. I need to eat chocolate ice cream all day, every day. And then they go a little bit further, get their teens, and they find sex. And they go, forget ice cream. I just found the pot at the end of the rainbow. This is the solution I've been looking for. I have never felt so happy, so complete in all of my life. And so what the brain does is takes one of the pleasurable needs that God has given us and overindulges it. And it goes outside of his design for that need. And that, when I teach this to addicts, I go, think back before you ever found drugs and alcohol. What was your first addiction? Because that's what this is. You just developed an addiction to chocolate ice cream. You just developed an addiction to sex. And the light bulbs go on. And they go, wow, I was an addict from three on because I loved chocolate ice cream and I used it to feel better about everything. And that was their thing. So, but here's what they find. It's like salt water. It seems to satisfy your thirst, but it just makes you thirstier. And that, when you step outside of God's design, it seems to work, then it backfires. And it makes the hole in your heart even bigger. And so then there's a second part of this, and that is what can happen is the brain wires get crossed. And here's what I mean. So let's say a kid is sad. And like many grandmas did 50 years ago, they go, here's a cookie. That'll make you feel better. And so now what they understand is if I have a hurt, an emotional hurt, the solution is physical food. And they begin to try every time they're hurting to solve it with food. Or a person is really lonely. And then they long for intimacy, they long for relationship, and so they have a one-night stand or they pick up pornography and they go, the solution to loneliness is a one-night stand. They try to meet a need which calls for intimate, healthy relationships, but the one-night stands seem to fix that need so the wires get crossed. And that is what happens for many, many people as they go along, is they begin to think, I meet emotional needs through physical activities. And they get very confused. And so what has to begin to happen is people need to get taught, how do I meet those needs that God placed in me that are so powerful? I've been meeting them the wrong way, either outside of healthy or I've got the wires crossed. I need to have a process of beginning to understand how to take care of the needs placed in me the right way. And that is the journey of recovery, is learning how to meet God-given needs the right way. So I tell clients, true recovery isn't about really not about not using. True recovery is learning how to be healthy, learning how to meet the needs God placed in me. And if I do that, I end up with joy. Now, I have to make a distinction here. I ask clients all the time, what's the difference between joy and happiness? And they scratch their heads and look blank. So let me explain it this way. And this is kind of my easy to remember version. I say happiness is based on happenings. In other words, happiness is based on circumstances or my external world. So what does our society teach us? If you're not happy, we go, if only I had more money. If only I lost some weight. If only I had a better job or a better boss. What are we doing? We're looking at our external world and saying, that's the reason I'm not happy. And so what you find with happiness is it fluctuates based on my circumstances. We don't like fluctuating happiness. We want to find, is there a constant? That's joy. You want to know joy is based on having a healthy internal world. It is having my spiritual needs met in a healthy way, my emotional needs met in a healthy way, my relational needs met in a healthy way, my physical needs met. When I am meeting all of them, I have completeness. I have joy. And guess what then happens? It doesn't matter if my outside world and the circumstances are kind of crappy, because my happiness or my joy doesn't depend on that. It depends on an internal world that is right. And that is the difference. And so our whole culture is gone in the direction, and addiction takes it to its nth degree, that you can be happy if you have a good job, lots of money, and all of the external world is perfect. That is a lie. You want to know, I don't like many things about addiction, but here's the one thing I like. You could have a person who has complex trauma and is following the world's lie, and they're getting more money, and they're planning on retiring early, and they're going to move to Gabriel Island because it's an ideal little Garden of Eden kind of thing, and they're going to be happily ever after, okay? Our whole society is doing that. You know what? They could live the rest of their life and die hanging on to that lie. They might not be very joyous, but they'll have pleasure, and it'll fluctuate. You want to know what addiction does? A person pursues happiness, pleasure, to the nth degree, and finds out it's all a lie. And that's what I love about addiction, is that it takes people to a place where they can no longer believe the outside is the cause of my problems. It takes you to a place where you have to say, something's wrong in me. And if I don't fix that, I will die. Now, nobody likes to change internally, and that's the next thing addiction does, because it says if you don't change, you will die. Because that's exactly where it's going to take you. It will gives you some consequences that are so painful and difficult that I can no longer blame it on anything else. I have to change me. And that is what happens in the world of addiction, but that's the way God designed us. Now, let me come back to this spiritual thing. If you look at our world today, we would put physical needs as number one priority, then emotional and relational needs as next, and then spiritual, well, if you want to, it's not a big deal. It's the least important. God says, love the Lord with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength is the greatest commandment. Now, it's not like God's some egomaniac and he says, everybody worship me. He's saying, I have designed life that the spiritual should be the most important, and then the physical and emotional. You've got it backwards in society. You're emphasizing the stuff that is the least important. Do you realize that a person, if you were to go to Africa where there's great poverty, and my daughter was in Nairobi and went into the slums there, some of the happiest people in the world. Their physical needs aren't met. They live in abject poverty in little hovels. But their spiritual needs are right. Their relationships are right. Their emotional needs are right. There's joy. Physical is the least important, but that's what we've made the most. And God says the most important is the spiritual. Now, here's how I think in pictures, as you've probably figured out. Two ways that I look at it. Yesterday, I talked about our solar system. And so the sun of the solar system, God is saying, needs to be God. And then we revolve around that. And what that means is that everything we do, we take our cues from God. Our priorities, we take our cues from God. That's number one. Number two illustration is I think of a baby with an umbilical cord. And what happens in idolatry when we look to other things other than God to give us life? Is like a person takes the umbilical cord that got cut from mom but still is there, and they plug it into sex and they say, give me life. I'm going to draw my life and my completeness from you. It doesn't work. It looks like it, but it's like salt water. God said, here's what you do. You come into the world and you take your umbilical cord and you plug it into God. And you say, I'm going to draw the deepest nourishment for my soul from you. Then I will take care of my physical needs through relationships and being responsible. But the heart of what keeps me alive is plugging into you and placing you as the main source of my life. That was God's design. But we're slow learners. So here's what I think God did. He created in all of us a spiritual hunger. Do you realize that most don't even realize it's there? They're not aware of it. It's not something you feel on a daily basis intensely. What happens when people get into addiction and get to a very dark bottom? All of a sudden that comes awake. But here's what I think God did. He took all of our physical needs and he designed them to also be signs that pointed to a spiritual comparable need. So we sit down and we feel hunger. And what is God saying? Because Jesus said, I am the bread of life. I am the water, the living water. He is saying, you also have a spiritual hunger, a spiritual thirst. And then he created us for sex and procreation. And what does that do in us? We have a longing for intimacy with God. We have a longing to reproduce ourselves and make disciples, not just little physical children, but spiritual children. God has built into us that longing for awe so that we will finally find him. And we will stand in awe of him and we'll do that forever. But he is saying the greatest fulfillment of your hunger isn't in food. It's in him. The greatest fulfillment of your thirst isn't in water or drink, it's in him. The greatest fulfillment of sex isn't in physical sex, it's in spiritual intimacy. The greatest fulfillment of the longing for an awe experience is found in him. Everything is designed to point to this longing deep in us that can only be fulfilled by Him, and that becomes the foundation, the source of all life for us. I hope that helps you. I hope it gives you some insight. So when you work with people who don't come from good places in their childhood, know this. They have many, many needs that have never been met in a healthy way. They don't often know how to begin to meet those needs. And so there's an element that's spiritual, yes, and I emphasize that, but we have to help them meet their emotional needs and their relationship needs. They need help in all different areas, not just spiritual. So if we're going to be faithful in representing God in this world, we have to broaden the sphere of our message to not just spiritual, but to all the other needs. And as we do that, people will find God, but they'll find joy. Let's just pray together. Father, David said that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And as we look at the very beginning of the Bible, you tried to give us a picture of what our needs are and how complex and beautiful we are, but how easily we neglect or they're not met. And I pray for anybody here this morning who just feels that hole in their heart in a very intense way, palpable way, that you would meet them and that you would make all of us sensitive to people who are hurting and just help us to know how to reach out and love and nurture them in the way they need. Amen.